Okay, everybody, welcome back to the Constant Honesty Podcast. This is episode number 54 with Dr. Larry Snyder. You are listening to a tune called The Hammer by David Rutter, performed by the University of Akron Steel Drum Band. But first, this episode of the podcast is brought to you by Liquid Drum. Liquid Drum is all about percussion and community. They're a very, very small organization spreading humongous ideas through drums, percussion, and music in general. Whether performing, teaching, or simple sharing, Liquid Drum values the communal aspects of creating music and having a good time whilst doing it. You can find them on the web at liquiddrum.com or check out their extensive percussion video library on YouTube and Vimeo. Also today, brought to you by Kyle Dunleavy and his steel drums. Kyle makes steel pans exclusively for me. Not exclusively for me. I exclusively play steel drums made by Kyle Dunleavy. Just wanted to be clear. Kyle has been making drums since 1999. He studied with Dr. Ellie Manette, as well as other U.S.-based instrument companies. He has performed with the Phase 2 Pan Groove down in Trinidad, as well as Cyperia Deltones and the Southern Marine Steel Band Foundation. Kyle is a nice guy, and he works real hard. He's accessible, and he's never let me down. He makes great instruments. Check him out and his drums. He makes a low G lead pan played by Victor Provost, and the double seconds I play of his are his signature low E double seconds. You can check his drums out at dunleavypans.com, dunleavypans.com. And finally, this episode of the podcast is brought to you by Small World Coffee. I drank a lot of coffee at the University of Akron. It wasn't good coffee, but it got me through the day. The older I got, the snootier I got about my coffee and where it came from and who was making it. And let me tell you, the folks at Small World Coffee in Princeton, New Jersey, they're at the top of the heap. They're loyal people. They're nice people. All the staff enjoys working there, it seems to me, which tells me that the people who are running that place have their heads screwed on straight. They have two locations in Princeton, New Jersey, one on Nassau Street and the other on Witherspoon Street. If you don't live in Princeton, no big deal. Go online, www.smallworldcoffee.com, and you can go to the page there, click on the I want to order 95 bags of coffee. There's not actually that link, but if you wanted 95 bags of coffee, you can go to their page, you can order it, they'll ship it to you. Smallworldcoffee.com, check them out, Princeton, New Jersey. All right, my guest today is another one of my heroes in life, a man named Dr. Larry Snyder. He's been teaching at the University of Akron for about the last 40 years, and he is sort of patient zero for a lot of the steel band scene, at least in Ohio for sure, and the students who are out there teaching and performing it, and definitely he was a huge influence on me. Exposing me to folks like Cliff Alexis and the music of Trinidad and Tobago and David Rutter and Bugsy Sharp and just Liam Teague, you name it. Larry was the sort of main force in my life. And for reasons I won't go into, Larry gave me a second chance. And I can't thank him enough for that. He's the reason I'm doing what I'm doing today. He's the, for whether he'll admit it or not, the reason I am with my current favorite person in the world, my wife, Stephanie Kirshner. Anyway, Larry's my hero. I hope you enjoy this podcast. Again, you are listening to the University of Akron Steel Drum Band performing a tune called The Hammer by David Rutter. All right, enjoy this podcast, everybody. Talk to you soon. Dr. Larry Snyder. We were just talking about YouTube rep, like looking at YouTube.
Right, right.
When I was in school here, I mentioned that I was having some serious flashbacks walking down this hallway, and it's totally true. But even it wasn't that long ago, but just even back in 2000, that was 2000 to 2003 four-ish is when I was here. There was no YouTube. You couldn't, if I wanted to play a piece, I had to figure it out.
Yeah, you had to explore it. And you had to use your mind by playing it and saying, well, what happens here? How can I do this? How do I stick that? How do I do all that?
Right.
But now they get on YouTube and they find some bad presentations or sometimes some good ones.
Yeah.
But it's a different world.
Well, the only way that I could get a copy of a piece was to either buy a DVD of it and watch it, so there was you know, and the folks who generally did that were professionals like Steve Schick.
Yeah, right.
Trying to think if I even bought any other performance DVDs of anybody. Like what's that piece? Corporel.
Corporel?
By Vinko Globokar.
Well, yeah. The only problem with it, well, you can see that now. Where
you can now, but yeah, not when...
No, you had that. Your whole theater had to come from someplace else. Your own intuition of what you wanted to do, which is cool.
Which is cool and also led me to many terrible decisions that I think, you know, I would have...
Yeah, but you learn from that, those terrible decisions. Sometimes you learn a lot more from stupid things that you do than from successes that you've had.
I think there's a real... I've only been teaching for... This is my 13th year at NYU. And, you know, you notice the decision-making process is slowly changing with every generation of students.
Sure.
And how they unearth their own ideas or their own... And the things they'll bring to the table aren't the things that I used to bring to the table.
Right.
Because I didn't have the time. I was, like, starting from zero. So they're starting with all of this data to begin with.
Yeah.
And it's trying to find the signal and all that noise that, you know, what's the right, like, did you find a good performance of this? Are you like learning about the piece because you heard a great performance?
Right.
Or is it somebody that's put up an iPhone in their basement and put up a performance? And sometimes that could be a great performance.
Absolutely. You know, absolutely.
It's not always the most highly produced performances that are the greatest. You know, you may find some kid in his basement.
I started something also kind of on the same level of that, of what we're talking. But I started something a couple years ago. When a student has a recital, the student has to make out their own program with all the details and describing the piece and all that. They have to do that. And what we do is I do not proofread it. I put that particular thing on the board out here, and the whole studio proofreads it.
Oh, no. Did we do that when I was here?
Uh-uh.
Okay, that's new. I would be horrified to know what Ron Martin would edit on my, or Jason Little or Adam Wells, like letting them edit my program would have been.
But I can tell you right now that a lot of my students are very, 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 very on top of academics and are carrying some very good, and they don't know how to write. And you would see, if you saw one, I wish I had one that was yesterday, I won't mention any names, but it was blood red. The students had gone after that, and they look forward to it now, correcting somebody else's. Your spacing is wrong here. Yeah. You've done this. And that's part of why I ask you about what was your birthday. For some reason, Allison's putting your date of birth on something, and her recital's this afternoon. Mm-hmm. And she asked me, I said, he's going to be in my office tomorrow morning. What? Josh Quillen's going to be in your office tomorrow morning? I said, 8:00. I said, I'll ask him there then.
Yeah. July 11th, 1979, Allison. Anybody else who needs it, I'm not giving you my social, though.
Yeah, but that's pretty, you know.
That's an interesting approach. I mean, it's sort of, I mean, and that's a generational thing, too. I think students are maybe more comfortable with that because of things like which, do you know about, like, Wikipedia?
Yeah.
Is a crowdsourced editing. It's an encyclopedia, basically, but it's edited by crowdsourcing. So there's a good friend of mine who's this guy, Ed Fitzgerald, who's part of a project that I did. And he fancies himself a Wikipedia editor. And he's like, I don't know what the accreditation is to get to become one, but when he makes an edit, it has to be approved by 15 other people. It's like, it's not one sort of source that's deciding. Everybody's sort of, and I think this generation is just more used to that. Even in my generation, you just did it by yourself. And if there was a mistake, most people just were in your class. Didn't occur to them that they should edit your stuff for you. Like, it was just Adam spelled his name wrong on the program, you know?
Well, it is interesting because it brings to light the students looking at somebody else's program and making editing comments about things about the piece. How do you know this? That's an incomplete sentence. The whole thing. Why did you put that in there? Mm. Oh, you said that twice in the same paragraph.
Yeah.
It's a totally different scene.
What year is this for you teaching here? We're at the University of Akron, by the way, in your office.
Yes, we are.
Which you've been here for how long?
39.
39 years?
Yes.
So your first year teaching was?
76,
okay. Can you tell me a little bit about your path to get that landed you here? Give me the nickel and dime tour, and we'll take side streets along the way.
Okay. Got a bachelor's degree at Illinois State University in music education.
Where were you born?
Oh, where was I born? Oh, we're going back that far.
You don't have to go give me every detail, but where
Kewaunee, Illinois.
Okay,
Western Illinois, small town, in Western Illinois, my big thing then was I played basketball on the basketball team in Kewaunee High School.
You're a pretty short person in general.
Right now, I actually I was one of the tallest. That's another generation thing where I'm 6'3".
Yeah.
And now everybody's the small ones, the forwards, the guards, 6'3". And but my big passion was playing in drum and bugle corps. My big passion was playing, of which there was in Kewaunee, Illinois, drum and bugle corps, playing drum set. I was playing three nights a week, and I had a great teacher who was a factory worker in a drum corps, and he just kind of stuck with me all the time. He was a great, great teacher and gave me the push. Mm-hmm. later on, I went to, I think you'll find this very interesting. When I was in high school, again, I didn't like marching bands much because I was like a drum corps guy, and I wanted to play drum set. So I had some good teachers doing that. My grandfather used to take me to Chicago, in Frank's Drum Shop, get drum lessons at Frank's Drum Shop. My grandfather and I were very close. My grandfather did this when he took me on the train to Chicago for my drum set lessons. Mm-hmm. With Roy Knapp, and I walk into place and I got my sticks, and Roy Knapp's like this huge guy, and he looks mean, and there's Gene Krupa, and there's Buddy Louis Belson in there, and I don't know, I'm just a kid. Mm-hmm. Well, interestingly enough, my grandfather used to say, okay, so if he says you did a good lesson, I'm going to take you to a White Sox game. And here I am in a big town with my grandfather. So that's what made me practice. Mm-hmm. That's in Kewaunee, Illinois, nobody practiced. But it made me practice because Grandpa said, I get to go to see the White Sox. So Grandpa used to escape during my lesson. He didn't sit and wait for me like parents do during lessons for little kids with their sticks and their stuff. Mm-hmm. He just escaped. Didn't pay attention to that, you know. About 5 years ago, I'm sitting with my cousin in Dallas, Texas, and my cousin said, "Well, you did know what Grandpa was doing." I said, "No." He said, "Well, he was a bootlegger for Al Capone." I said, "You're kidding me!" But my grandfather was the biggest tough guy, was the biggest wuss crybaby in the world, but he loved, he did what he did. So that was part of bringing me up, me becoming. The other thing that was very interesting that I think you would enjoy is in high school, my parents used to have a card party on Sunday night, and they have pie, just typical farm community kind of people, blue collar. And I was watching TV bored, and I had on The Ed Sullivan Show, which was black and white TV. In those days, it was three channels, ABC, NBC, CBS. And they had this really stupid thing on it. It was called a steel band. I looked at that, and I saw, isn't that the biggest piece of garbage trash I've ever seen in my life? The people, look at this garbage. They're just beating on old trash cans. Mm-hmm. Little did I know that that was going to be a part of my life. I had no interest in that garbage at all. Mm-hmm. In that band was Clifford Alexis. Mm-hmm. Did I ever meet him at that time? That's how weird things happen.
Was this the, what was the name of the band?
The National Steel... Okay. Yeah.
It wasn't in the Trinidad Tripoli.
No. It was the National Steel Band. They were making a tour.
Right, okay.
Yeah. So isn't that weird?
How old were you at this time?
I can't tell you. It was a high school, early high school kind of situation, you know, and... Who wants to do that, man? I just want to play Radom Cues and Flams and be a bad drum corps guy and play in bands on Saturday night. That's how I got through school, quite frankly, is playing. My father never had a high school diploma.
Mm-hmm.
My mother did. And I remember my mother, I'd come home at night, my mother would be counting her tips. And I'd come home late, and maybe I had a couple beers in high school with my buddies out on the farm, because mm-hmm. that's where we go. We get somebody to get us some liquor, and then we go out drink.
Go hide in the cornfield.
Yeah. You know the scene, yeah. So I come home one night, and I could have stayed in Kewaunee, Illinois the rest of my life.
Yeah.
Because I had it made. I was playing drum corps. What else you need? And you know, what else you need? And I'm playing dance band. And I come home junior year in high school, and I saw my mom sitting, counting her tips, not dollars, but dimes, because she was a waitress. Mm-hmm. And I said, I remember this so distinctly. I can see her in her outfit and everything that they had to wear as waitresses and stuff at the hotel. And I said, Mom, what are you doing? She looked at me and she pointed her finger at me. And she says, you're going to college.
Yeah.
Because you're not going to be like your dad and I. That was the age, though, that World War II people that were in World War II, the big thing is my kids are going to be better than me.
I think I'm just young enough that the World War II generation was, you know, like my grandfather, the oldest person I knew was my grandfather, you know, in my high school years, like middle school. So the oldest person, and he seemed like ancient, but he was like 55, you know, at the time, like that's not old. And his hit where he fell in the World War II generation was on the later end. So I think when he was stationed in the Pacific Ocean, I think for a while, it was like 1945 through 47. So kind of on the tail end.
Yeah.
But the World War II generation, their mentality, like, I gotta imagine, had to, like, when you fight Nazis.
Yeah.
Like, real ones.
Yeah, yeah. Not as my dad
ones,
did.
Not the ones that show up on Twitter.
Yeah, you know, that's like, right.
You're face to face with somebody who is
right.
committing, and you're witnessing these atrocities that no one had ever dreamt of before.
Yeah, that's right.
I mean, atrocities have happened, but just, like, on that particular way it was happening.
Yeah.
I imagine when you come back, you see the whole world a different way. You come home, it's like the New Deal, like all of these, the GI Bill, all of these things that came out of this horrifying event. Like, just you look at every generation, you're like, we're coming out of this.
Yeah.
Like, we're not letting humanity sink back to this.
You're absolutely right. I agree with you. My father was in Germany fighting Nazis. Again, a boy who didn't get through high school, joined the army to save the world. That's what he did. You know, he was marched around. He would never talk about it, though,
yeah.
because it was just so devastating to see dead bodies.
Yeah, and, well, how did that, so this, you're what age now? And, like, so your mom is saving tip money to send you to college. When was the moment you felt like, I want to go to college to study music?
Well, I knew I had to be in music. The passion for music was a long time ago. I clear back to kindergarten, where I used to sit in front of a plastic drum set, and there was a piece called a show, black and white show called Big Top Circus, and the drummer was up there with a circus band, and I knew I wanted to beat on drums. Mm-hmm. So I knew that had to be a part of my life. It just had to be. I knew that from 5 years old.
Mm-hmm.
And I had a toy drum set my mother would buy, and I'd break it, and I couldn't understand why my heads broke easily, and the drummer, I can even still remember that. And So where it changed, where I going to college, I'm saying going to college, well, what the hell? I'll just be a music major because that's what I really like to do. And so I did. At this point, it was Illinois State University. All they had was a music education degree. So I was a music education major, and that's what I did. Roger Fahlman was a good timpanist. He was my teacher there. He went to University of Michigan, was a Duff style timpanist, and he taught me a lot about timpani, not so much about the rest of the percussion stuff, but that was like a major deal. And there was only like two or three percussion majors at Illinois State. And the reason why I went to Illinois State was, like so many people, my friends went to Illinois State, and it was an easy drive home.
Yeah,
you know, if I wanted to get home.
Yeah.
So that's what happened there. After that, I got a job teaching in Bradley, Illinois, and it was middle school job, band director. Bradley is very close to Kankakee, which is very close to Chicago, and definitely somewhat of a blue-collar community, and I enjoyed doing that. I did that for, I have to go back and say that I went from undergraduate degree. I did go to University of North Texas then, because that was the next step for me. For my master's degree, master music. That was a performance degree. And I spent time there and enjoyed that, a whole different flavor than Illinois State University. And Ron Fink was a teacher there, and he was a good teacher, and I learned what to do. That's the nice thing about having several teachers is nobody's 100% perfect, and nobody's 100% bad, because you can, a lot of times, learn a lot more from a bad teacher than a good teacher. What not to do.
Yeah.
After that, I came back to Illinois. And had this job at Bradley and did that for 5 years and enjoyed that. I was basically a middle school band director. After that, I had the itch to play. I was playing in Chicago a lot on the weekends. So I said, you know, I got to have a doctorate. I want a doctorate. I want to go back to school. I itch for playing. I itch. And when you're teaching 5 days a week, you don't even want to turn on the radio at the end of the day.
Yeah, let alone practice stick
control. Let alone practice stick control or scales, you know. So I just kind of started saying, okay, I got to, if I'm going to do this, if I'm going to get a DMA at Illinois, because Illinois was the first DMA in terms of performance, and they had the
first university that offered that for percussion.
Yeah, right, for percussion, yeah. So then I practiced every day after school, and got into the department. Auditioned, went down and got my doctorate over a period of time. Finished it in '83, but I actually was down there, got a job at Idaho State University as a percussion teacher, and. I was followed by Rick Karaz. He had the job after I did. Got the job at Western Illinois, Rick Karaz.
Yeah.
Came back. There was a job opening at this school called University of Akron. And Idaho was such a outdoorsy, all the money really went to outdoors things, skiing, hunting, that sort of thing. Beautiful place.
I don't think I've ever been to Idaho, actually.
And it was beautiful. And everybody just like got on their skis on a weekend. I mean, that's the way it was.
Yeah.
And went hunting also was another thing. And I decided this is not a place that's going to develop me in terms of what I want. So I started looking around for schools back here in this Midwest thing. And there was this place called Akron, University of Akron. And it had like five openings. Usually when you see five openings, you think, things are falling apart there.
You mean the music school had
the
five
music openings. School had yeah. five openings. Yeah, so I got it. You know, well, it'll get me back in the Midwest.
Yeah,
and then I can find a real gig. Okay, and I can play, but I can still I can get a better school. So I auditioned here, and I found out that the five gigs were five new positions. Mm. That they added on full-time positions. So it was percussion, there was trombone, there was, you know, other. So before prior to that, it was a school in which it was all part-time people coming in and doing their thing and then leaving at the end of the day, and they teach and wasn't.
But there was a percussion program here?
No.
Not at all?
No. There any was a percussion teacher, but there wasn't any majors.
Okay.
Actually, there was a couple majors, and the only reason why they were majors is they had a pulse.
Mm-hmm. Well, that's how I got in.
No, that's not how you got in. No, but so I said, well, this will be all right. All right, so took this job, and our chairman at that time, Frank Bradshaw, was a tough bird, very tough bird. Mm-hmm. And he was able to wangle in and out of stuff and talk politics and stuff. And he built the entire department. Mm. And that's how I got here. That's when I got here, I would ask for something. And the first thing he would say is no. And then you go figure out how I was going to get it.
You told a funny story about you when you auditioned. You got the gig, and you said, "No, I need one thing. We do need is we need a xylophone or a snare drum or whatever it was." And then you showed up, and it wasn't here.
Oh,
can you talk a little bit about your negotiating style?
Well, yeah. I said there was actually nothing. There was a beat up xylophone. There was a snare drum and a set of cymbals and a bass drum. Mm-hmm. I said, I've got to have more than this. I've got to have this. No problem, Frank said. No problem. We'll get you what you want. Just send us a list of stuff and some prices. So I went back to Idaho, finished up my year, mm-hmm. and getting ready to come back here. And I had a list of stuff. And I wasn't outlandish about it. I was just some basic things like marimba, like, you know, mm-hmm. all kinds of cymbals. Not all kinds, just give me a pair of cymbals.
Right.
Yeah. And as a result of that, I was already come back, and I wanted to come back early so that I could get my studio all set up. Mm-hmm. And I found out that my studio was nothing but a practice room that was on the third floor, very similar to by 6 foot place. That mm-hmm. was where I was supposed to teach, mm-hmm. and that's where I was supposed to practice, etc. But I got here, there was nothing. Mm-hmm. They hadn't ordered it. Tough. Too bad. So I just started negotiating with other people on campus and made some enemies in the department to get what I needed to make this happen. Eventually, it worked out pretty well.
Yeah, I would say 39 years later. And
yeah.
So now, when did the move to the basement happen?
Oh. Wow. We had one practice room on the, so I had a studio on the top floor, third floor. Then where the practice areas are now, there was one practice room for students, but there's only like three students anyway. And, you know, they were here because they were trying to find themselves, you know. Mm-hmm. Then I have to think about this a little bit. Music education people, this used to be a storage area for music education, mm-hmm. this whole area. Mm-hmm. Okay. And they decided they didn't want that. They wanted the second floor. Well, put a whole music education complex up there. Mm-hmm. Okay, so what are we going to do down here? I don't know. What happened is they wanted me to move down here. Because I was making so much noise, and I did a really good job of that. So I had I'm teaching percussion in a room that's 6x6, and we're playing snare drum, and there's a vocal teacher next door.
Right.
So they wanted me as far away from them.
That's not a sustainable setup there.
That's right, right. And they the whole faculty said, no, just let's get the percussion in a different world. Yeah. Just any place but here. And so they moved me down here, and then gradually I picked up this room, and then we expanded the practice rooms, et cetera. And now we pretty much basically own the entire floor, which is kind of nice. In fact,
it's been a slow-moving coup for like the last 39 years. Just taking over a closet, then another room, and then the next room.
No, the politics of this is amazing.
Yeah.
We had Jihei here last month.
Yeah.
Who's just a sweetheart, just a wonderful player. Mm-hmm. Oh, we really liked her. And she came, the first thing she did when I said, you want to see our facility? And she came down and she says, you have this whole floor. And most of our guests come down and say, wow, you got your own world down here. Mm-hmm. And I said, yeah, actually we do. We even have... even since you were here, we have room 20, which is and that's a multiple setup room. And you know how we got that? We set up all of our multiple setups in the band room. So when a band came in, instruments were always ringing and knocking over and all that stuff. And the music education people just hated that.
Yeah.
So I said, give them something else. Get out of here. It makes us look trashy. So. Yeah. Got that room.
Worked out okay.
You just play the politics. That's one of the things I think you have to do. You can sit and be a professor that goes, oh, woe is me. I don't do... sometimes you don't follow the rules and you get what you want.
Yeah, you have to know what pressure point to push.
Mm-hmm.
That's going to cause the least amount of pain.
Exactly.
The least amount of short-term pain or the longest amount of like long-term little pinpricks that just get really annoying over a long time, and then they finally just give and are like, why don't we just get you out of this?
Well, it took me about a year or so, a little over a couple years, of being here and being successful, where a band director say, I need this, blah, blah, blah. Could you do a sectional here? I was always on call, on call, and I did it. And they found out that I was worthy of something besides just hitting crap.
Yeah.
Okay. And as a result of that, I was going back and finishing my doctorate at Illinois at some particular time. And I recall, just like, because Illinois had a good program there with Tom Siwi, who was my teacher, and just they had 20 full-time composers. Can you believe that? And we were all practicing and doing our stuff and all the time, and everybody was very serious late at night, and we're doing all that. And one night, I can't really describe this very well, because it's just like a flash. One night, one of the students, it might have been Greg Zuber, but I'm not so sure it was him, who has his own job right now. Mm-hmm. Anyway,
he plays with the Met.
Yeah.
A tiny pickup band.
Yeah, a tiny little group. Somebody had this old trash can. It was rusty. And they were sitting late at night, just like in the University of Akron's late night hangs. Mm-hmm. Everybody's trash talking. Everybody's, typical drummers.
Mm-hmm.
And they're playing on this trash can. And they all look extremely happy, goofy happy, hitting this thing, how stupid this is. It's how stupid. I forgot about that because I just saw this on the Ed Sullivan Show a few years back. It's crap. I got to the University of Akron and I thought, that wasn't such a bad idea. Everybody was happy. Everybody was, pretty much together.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to try to, since I'm kind of on a roll down here now,
mm-hmm.
on a roll of success. I'm getting students in.
Mm-hmm.
I'm here 5 days a week, 6 days sometime.
Mm-hmm.
I'm going to, Frank Bradshaw can get just about anything he wants. I think what I'm going to do is go see if I can start one of these can band things.
Mm-hmm.
I go into Frank and he says, that's a really stupid idea. We're not doing that. I said, okay. A couple days later, he calls me. What is that trash can crap? I can remember, so I said, well, steel drums, it's a world music thing.
Mm-hmm.
Says, go talk to Gazzetta. Gazzetta, it was the president. And Frank and Gazzetta were like this. I said, sure. And most young faculty don't want to go to the president's office because I thought, God, mm-hmm. it's the president's office.
Yeah.
So I went in there. And it's interesting that the president had a party for all the new faculty. And the president played gut bucket. He was a gut bucket player.
What's a gut bucket?
It's a big trash can that people would do their laundry in with a post and a wire that you would pluck like bass drum. Okay. Right. Gut bucket.
All right.
So I went in there and I said, I'm going to start a steel band. And I explained to him that he said, that's just garbage. He says, we're not doing that. That's an embarrassment to this university. I said, and I started telling him, you know, be the obvious what was going on and all that stuff.
What year is this, Bob?
79, I believe.
Okay.
See, we're almost 40 years old here.
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Next year, 40th anniversary of a steel band.
Mm.
So after talking to him and Frank talking to him and playing the politics, he said to me, this is stupid. He says, but you know what? I'm going to let you try it. I'm going to show you how stupid you are to have this thing. He says, we'll get it. We'll do it. I said, "What? Okay, I'll give you all the money for it. I'm going to buy it. It works. Great. Pay me back.
Mm-hmm.
He couldn't say no to that.
Mm-hmm.
He said, I remember him looking at me and taking his index finger and pointing at me. He says, if you embarrass this university with this trash can band, he says, you have to resign. I said, okay.
You're like, what is the definition of embarrass?
Well, and I did say the wrong thing. I said, well, let's look at it this way. A trash can, and you play gut bucket, get out of here.
Yeah. It was one bridge too far.
Oh, so we had people like the early people like Bob Anora and Ben Toth in the band, and they were majors here now.
Mm-hmm.
Okay, and we had to take the pans, and we had to they were in the practice rooms. I didn't know where I was going to put them, and we'd have to take them into a band room.
Mm-hmm.
And set them up, and then you get at least 10 minutes to practice because you had to get them back before the next class. So that was a pain.
Well, we skipped a step here. Where you went from him giving you approval, but when you walked out of his office, what was the next phone call you made?
That's a good one because I called Tom Siwi, mm-hmm. and I said, where do I get drums? Because he, at that time, had an established band at Illinois. He says, call Al O'Connor. Called Al O'Connor at Northern. He said, okay, so the best bands, Cliff Alexis. I said, okay, I'll call
At this
him.
Point in the United States, there were really only two. It was Cliff and Ellie Manette in West Virginia.
Well,
was Ellie there by that point?
No, not yet.
Okay.
It was Northern Illinois, I believe. I'm not so sure. I'm not so sure, but I don't think so. It was Cliff Alexis in terms of a university sponsored credit approved band.
Mm-hmm.
I think I believe Ellie came later than that at West Virginia.
But was he in the States tuning at that point?
I don't know.
Okay.
Ellie, I don't know.
All right.
But it was Northern Illinois, then University of Illinois, and then I was basically, as far as accredited band, large band, I was third
mm-hmm.
in the country,
okay.
as I know it. Mm-hmm. I don't know. I didn't know everybody.
Yeah, sure.
As a result of that, I called, and Al said to Al O'Connor at Northern Illinois said, Cliff Alexis. He's here. He just moved from Minnesota or something and mm-hmm. had a small band up there. And I called Cliff, and we did not hit it off at all.
Very few people did with Cliff right out
of
the gates.
Yeah, and I asked him, I said, I said, I need some steel drums here. And he said, no. Click. I call back. As soon as he heard my voice, click. Next time I call back, this is before you could leave a message on the phone. I said, I want to talk to you. He says, I want some steel drums. I've been told by Al, but called by Siwi. You build them for Siwi? You built it in Northern Illinois. Everybody says, you the guy. He says, I ain't building no drums for you. You're just another white boy that wants some novelty instrument. You have no interest and no knowledge of the history of us. He says, no. Click. I call back again. I said, oh, Cliff, I'm going to keep calling you, man. I'm going to do this every day. I'm going to call you. Click. Next couple days, kept calling him. Mm-hmm. Finally says, all right, I'll build you some drums. So between then and getting them, and Tom Siwi showed up, and we, bit by bit, it was like, here's a set of basses, but you're going to have to play the lead parts on marimba, you know. Mm-hmm. So it was like a little bit of this and a little bit of that, and Scott Lyons.
At this point, he was, I mean, for most of his life building, he was basically doing it by himself.
Yeah. And so we started adding. He realized that I was pretty adamant about the knowledge. I didn't know anything about him, but I did know that they were fun. Mm-hmm. Until he started showing up to tune and tell me the history of stuff, because it wasn't really written in a book. Mm-hmm. Of any priority at all.
Yeah.
And as a result, in the past, we just become very, very close. He's actually my best friend died.
Yeah. He passed away. What date did he die?
I don't know right now.
Almost a month now?
It's about a month. Right. Yeah. But we talked to each other every week.
Yeah.
His wife just sent me his hammer.
Whoa.
He died with a University of Akron t-shirt on.
Is that right?
Yeah.
But who buried him in a suit and tie?
I was afraid to ask that. No, I was afraid to ask that.
Maybe Yuko. If it was Yuko, it was like, just once I wanted him to dress up.
Suit and tie. And everybody, what was fun about that whole thing with him was, how can a funeral be fun? I don't know. But it was really a combination of crying and laughing.
Yeah.
A lot of Trinidadians showed up, mm-hmm. come up from Trinidad, who couldn't afford a plane ticket, but they found the time. Mm-hmm. They found the money to get there. Mm-hmm. And we were all saying, what's this about? What's this tie? He also had a New York Yankees cap.
He was always wearing a New York
Yankees cap. Yeah, right. So they buried him with that, too.
Well, Yuko, if it was your call to make that, to put him in a tie, then we'll give you a pass.
But
if it was somebody else.
That's right.
Well, so I'm looking at a picture right now of a bunch of your students in Trinidad.
Yeah. Right. Yeah.
And when I think back on my time here and at Dover High School, I'm going to talk to Joan Wenzel on Monday, who was a student of yours.
Yeah. She was in one of the original bands.
Yeah. And she's who turned me onto the steel drum. My first experience with a steel band, and Cliff, frankly, was her. And what I when I look at like what how it impacted my life, I used to think about just the facility on the instrument, like learning your scales, like that was, yes, I can play gigs, I can do all those things. I think the part of my life where it impacted me the most that I wasn't aware of at the time was culturally. Learning about something other than, and it's something people are talking about a lot right now, is your exposure to other things other than yourself. I grew up in Dover, Ohio, a white kid from a very white town. And that's not bad. I'm not saying that's a negative thing. It's just, it's true. It's just what happened.
Exactly like me.
Right. And Cliff was the first black person I think I'd ever seen. he came to Dover, I think, to tune one of the days he was here, probably at Akron Tuning. So he drove down to Dover, tuned there, and he just sat in the back, like, stewing about something. Like,
yeah.
Never said hello. I think he said hello to Joan. He never said anything to any of us. He just probably been like, hello, you know, and then that's it. Just terrifying. But not in a bad way. Just like, this guy is heavy.
Yeah.
There's an intense.
Don't mess with him. He knows his stuff.
Yeah.
And he's going to tell you what he thinks.
Can you talk about maybe that first trip? Like, you took your students down and what you've seen, how you've seen the steel band program here in particular and how it's impacted your students and what they, the importance of that sort of
thing. Well, that was a trip in which we got some money from the university to go down there. I think
what year is this?
Oh, Jesus, 84.
It's not like super long after the steel band started.
No, no, it's not. I mean, we got some real different people in there. Anyway,
was Joan in there? No, she was.
No, she was not there.
She was graduated by
then. Yeah, okay. Yeah, we went down there, and our exposure was basically the culture of a African-American culture.
Yeah.
And we went to Cliff, knew everybody who was running all the bands. So we would go around and listen to the bands. That was basically it. Pan Trinbago was very helpful that's the organization of Pan in Trinidad, the union, if you could call it a union.
Yeah.
And they showed us around, and that was basically the culture that we got exposed to. That was for most of those people, and I would say actually all of those people in that picture, all of those European-based people, it was an exposure to different food, to different culture, to different people, to blah, 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 right down the line. And that started the interest of, hey, there's more than just playing Yellowbird.
Mm-hmm.
There's more to it than that. Mm-hmm. Now, we were not just playing Yellowbird, but we were playing some pretty loose pieces.
Yeah.
And then stuff started happening. And we first realized, and getting on a plane coming home, and I think they did too. They didn't speak of it much, but the whole culture is, there's more to this than hitting drums.
Mm-hmm.
And there's been so many cool experiences since. And one of the things that I love about my friend Michael Spiro and Cliff Alexis and Bernard Woma, who recently died this year, is that it's now our responsibility, we have no choice, that we keep the culture and teach our students the culture of it. To have a steel band at any school is just, come on, man.
Yeah.
Well,
it's out of, that's something I'm becoming, it always strikes me every time I walk into, but we had just started a steel band at Princeton 2 years ago.
Yeah.
And at NYU, this is the 13th year there now.
Yeah.
And, you know, that particular room that steel band in is out of context of its real, like where it comes from. It's like playing an orchestra excerpt. Like, you can go, but that's not Scheherazade.
That's right.
You know, there's way more to this. And the the connection there for me is like, I can only take you so far as a white kid from Dover. And I feel like I've been involved in this art form for a long time, but I didn't grow up with it. I didn't eat the food I didn't sit on a little milk crate like Kendall Williams did.
Yeah. Or get beaten in the head
like Cliff did just for playing a steel drum, you know. It wasn't a crime for me ever to play steel band.
Yeah.
And for Cliff it was.
Yeah.
And
well, I got an interesting story about that.
Mm-hmm.
And if I start weeping, which I probably will, I apologize.
It's fine.
I was asked to go see the Prime Minister in steel band. Cliff arranged it to try to start an education where we're getting the Trinidadian children to learn to read music.
Mm-hmm.
So I went down to Trinidad. It's right on what you're saying here is really interesting. So we had the Pan Trinbago guys, and they were all in suits, and we're walking down the block and up to the prime minister's place, which is kind of cool. You know, it was like the president, you know, place. And we're walking down the block, and everybody's cool, and everybody's cool, and talking and trash talking, just the typical friends doing stuff like that. And then it got silent, and it was weird because everybody stopped talking, and I looked around, and I saw all of the guys. There was like five of them. And they stopped talking and started walking very slowly. Mm-hmm. And I said, come on, guys. What's up? And one of them, I can't tell you which one because I don't remember, said, in our day of pan playing, we were not allowed to walk in this block. And now we're walking into the prime minister's office. Mm-hmm. I said to them, you walk ahead of me, or I'm not going in. Mm-hmm. No. I said, okay, that's fine. I'm not going into place. Mm-hmm. And I was the authority of music education between them. Yeah. I said, either you walk ahead of me and me behind you, or I'm not going in. Well, that was a scuffle. They didn't like that at all, but they did. Yeah. And I'll never forget that. And it's kind of on the same thing. I didn't even understand that until it happened. And that's what your responsibility is, and mine, mm-hmm. and Matt Dudak's, and everybody that plays a pan, mm-hmm. is to keep that culture going. Tom Miller, in an email after Cliff died, Tom Miller's an alumnus of the University of Akron and publisher of, you know. I've got it on a bulletin board. One of these says it's our responsibility, mm-hmm. to never let that culture die, and just play cruise ship stuff. One of the things I've started this year, last year, might have you here as a judge someday, if they let me, because you're an alumnus, they might not let me. I started a scholarship just like it used to be for vibraphone. In my day, the vibraphone was a jazz instrument, and there was really no technique. My first vibraphone lesson was Tom Siwi at the University of Illinois, a Friedman book. Mm-hmm. If you play marimba, don't you play vibraphone?
Yeah.
No, you don't.
It's the same layout.
Well, and then you get Gita Steiner that started writing stuff.
Yeah.
And that, who unfortunately passed on of cancer, I'm told. And then there was like really way out stuff like Stuart Smith. Mm-hmm. And they started writing for concert instruments. And I thought, just a few years ago, I said, you know, that develop in most institutions now vibraphone work. In terms of college teachers are teaching the vibraphone as a different instrument than the marimba. What would happen if we did the same thing with steel drums? Mm-hmm. So the last year was the first year that Tuesday Musical Association, of which you've played some concerts for, mm-hmm. I talked to their board of directors about developing a pan marimba scholarship. Mm. In other words, you play marimba, solo marimba literature, and you play also, but you also have to play a contemporary, we'll call it, pan solo, of which people are now starting to write pan stuff that's not just... You had one at SOCI last year, mm-hmm. a young lady who was writing something for one of my students. Yeah. That's amazing piece. I don't even know the person's name. But anyway, so I said...
It's kind of just, I don't mean to interrupt, but I don't know the person's name either. And I initially was like, what, disappointed. But that's the way it should be. Like, if things progress after you teach, and you're not aware of it, like, that's kind of like, okay, good, I did my job. I'm going to go focus on other things.
Yeah.
Like, you're doing what I told you to do.
Yeah, I've planted the seed.
That's a good thing, yeah.
Yeah, and we had a fight. in the city of Akron, where the board of trustees from Tuesday Musical said, "We're not going to have that scholarship because we want real, quote unquote, real music for our competitions. We don't want to lower our standard." And they were thinking a concert marimba piece, maybe even Bach, maybe even Tanaka, whatever, whatever. But we don't want Yellow Bird to be played. Well, these were the same people on the board. Same people on the board that were looking at, and they said, "I don't think this is legitimate. Give us some pieces." So we got on the internet and showed Leon Teague playing some stuff, et cetera, et cetera. And we had a real struggle because a lot of the board members are cruise ship people. Yeah. So their attitude of a steel pan is what? Getting on a cruise ship, walking on with their suntan oil and all that stuff and their margarita and listening to Yellow Bird near the pool. Mm-hmm. It's not like that anymore. And that's what my goal is to make that as legitimate, if I can use that word. Mm-hmm. That's not maybe a good word, but a legitimate as a vibraphone used to be in the 60s.
Legit. I've always had a hard time figuring out what word is appropriate because I say legit, but it's like, to me, it's always been legitimate. Like, so to say, like,
yeah,
I mean, and of course to you too. I've always been what I want for is to be able to go set up a set of steel drums somewhere, and I'm slowly having this experience with the David Lang concerto. So we'll go and we set up in front of an orchestra, and I set up a pair of steel drums right behind the conductor, right in the center in front of the orchestra, and it's happening less and less. But every time I do it, fewer of the orchestra members are coming up and saying, "Ooh, steel drums! It's like a Caribbean night or something like that," you know. And it's not, they're not trying to be insulting or anything, but no one says anything anymore, which is like, okay. And every time I walk to those steel drums right before I play by myself in front of an orchestra, I have this moment. I remember, you know, that story you told of Cliff walking up those stairs, him showing me the two scars he had on the back of his head, talking about getting beat up for simply holding a steel drum as a kid, like him just talking about the number of times foreigners, the reason there's skepticism there of foreigners and white people is that there was cultural thievery for years and years and years. Like, that's cultural appropriation. That happened. Sure. And now every time I walk to the steel drums, I feel a little bit like, I think of Cliff. I think of, like, the things I didn't have to do, the things that people did ahead of me to allow me to go on and do this thing on this stage. And I think about the time I was in, like, the thing I learned about Trinidad, like, in Trinidad at a young age, at 19, when you let me go. I remember writing a grant to the university and saying that I was doing research in Trinidad, which I stand by to some degree, but research in Trinidad during February in Akron is very skeptical. I guess there's some real skeptical eyes from the administration. Like, you want to go to the Caribbean in February? But what it taught me was about racism and about how different cultures see each other. And the first time, and what it felt like to be the only one of my kind in a group of 130 people.
Yeah.
I think if everybody at the age when your brain is starting to form neurons and connections that then you see the rest of the world through, if everybody at that age, 18, 19, 20 years old, played in a steel band or was forced to, even for just like a week, just sit in a panyard, I think that a lot of the issues we are dealing with right now in terms of racism, otherism, I just think it would kind of go away. I mean, you realize standing in front of somebody who has long dreadlocks, a big scar across their face, dark, dark skin, speaking a language that you don't really understand, even though it's technically English, you know, that this is a human too. Like, you learn so quickly when you're face to face with the people that you're told about. You just learn. And I don't know. I just, like, of the things I've taken away from steel band world, and maybe I'm alone here, but, like, that's the thing I think, if that's the thing I've taken away. It's just an awareness of what other, like, I bought, when I went to Trinidad, I bought the set of seconds I played on. And it didn't dawn on me at the time that I was the only person in the band that was financially able to do that. As a stranger coming in, I was just like, oh, I'd like those. And I paid $1,000 and walked away. Except most of the people in the band who live there, who live 5 feet away from that panyard, don't own their own drums.
I've developed a philosophy in the back of my head as a teacher. And I think in looking back, when I become, 2 years ago, I think 2 years ago, I become distinguished professor. Mm-hmm. I think I'm one of the only distinguished professors in percussion in the country, which is a pretty high-ranking thing. You have to have an international reputation, obviously, and all that. So I'm not bragging. I'm just saying, I say, how did I get here? How did I get here? I come from a father who didn't have this. I come from a mother who was a waitress and had a high school diploma. I went to Michael Colgrass one time, and I said, you're a Pulitzer Prize winner, 1972, deja vu. Michael's always been kind of a person I look up to. I haven't talked to him for a long time. I should. He says, it's not that hard, man. It's not that hard. Tell me what's easy about it. He says, this is what you got to do. And I've kept this at the back of my head. He says, first of all, you need to work hard. Mm. Second of all, you got to hang out with creative people. Mm-hmm. The third thing you have to do is always be curious. Mm-hmm. I never thought of that. And it's true. And I've built my studio here on just that thing and just exactly what you're saying. It's falling in line. Is you were curious. Mm-hmm. You didn't look back. You hang out with curious people. You work hard. Mm-hmm. So maybe a Pulitzer Prize winner, we're going to both be.
Yeah, well, I mean, I think also embracing uncomfortable situations.
Well, that goes along with curiosity, doesn't it?
Right, but I don't know how to say this without sounding like an asshole, but I feel like the farther along we get in with social media, and people are very afraid or hesitant to embrace friction and uncomfortable moments. Like when I went to Trinidad, I was there for 3.5 weeks in 2002. For the first 2 weeks, nobody spoke to me except for the guy who was my handler. His name's Earl. And Almond St. Rose, who was the gentleman that Bugsy put in charge of teaching me the tune. And I'm sure Cliff called in a million favors for me behind the scenes, which is why I made it out of there in one piece. But no one said anything to me. No one acknowledged me. No one said good job. No one said bad job. I was just there. In feeling alone, feeling by myself, feeling like I didn't know what to say, what not to say. I didn't know, is it okay to go get a beer now? Am I going to get in trouble if I'm late? Oh my God. Okay. They said rehearsals at 7, but nobody showed up till 9:30. Okay. Then do I show up at 9:30? And it took like the first week and a half went by, and then I just decided to show up at 9:30. Well, they started at 7. Like, what the hell? Like, I don't understand this culture. What's going on? But I didn't feel like it was right for me to say anything. I just kept my head. And then about 2 weeks in, the gentleman behind me, wearing a full Black Panther, like the army fatigues, the Black Panther patch and the beret, was playing cellos or guitars behind me. And he tapped me on the shoulder, and I turned around, terrified. And he just said, hey, my name's so-and-so, and nice to meet you. You're doing a really great job. And it was like, sometimes you just got to put in your time. Correct. Sometimes you just got to bite the bullet, keep your head down. Did I hear a lot of things in those 2 weeks that I didn't agree with culturally? Yeah. I didn't understand why certain people were talking to each other the way they were. I would never talk like that. I didn't understand that. But then the more you're there, the more you understand why certain cultures work. The ecosystem in which everybody is participating is way messier in Trinidad than it was in Dover, Ohio.
Yeah.
And that's okay. It's just, it was really uncomfortable 2 weeks. And if I'd raised my hand and been like, hey, I was just triggered by what you just said.
Yeah.
Or, you know, I'm really offended by what you just said. And I said that the first day. I'm fairly certain I wouldn't be sitting here right now. Yeah. And I definitely wouldn't be playing steel drums. I think I would have sort of been cleaved from that society. It's like, well, if you're not willing to, if you're not willing, I was beat on the head for holding this instrument. And if you're not willing to stand there for 2 weeks in the sun in the Caribbean playing steel drums with your mouth shut, then I'm sorry, we're not putting in the effort to show you this.
Yeah. Well, that's your curiosity. That's part of your curiosity. Yeah. I learned when to back off. I'm curious about what they said and how you learn and do that. I totally understand that.
Well, I want to switch gears real quick before we wrap up. You also, one of the other things I remember taking from here was your you have a side interest in it's called neurolinguistic programming.
Correct.
And you gave a big lecture one day, not a lecture, but a class, a demonstration on sort of how that stuff works. Can you just talk a little bit? At the time, it was fairly pop psychology, and I think, and I remember you saying that, like, there's a few books you could get, but it wasn't necessarily accepted by mainstream psychological, like, but now I'm seeing it pop up more and more in articles. Yeah. I'm hearing other people like write about it as if it's a thing. Can you talk a little bit about what that is and how you got turned on it? Well, and how you utilize it?
Well, Bandler and Grinder wrote a book, Heart of the Mind. Michael Colgrass used to come here and teach a whole week of that many years ago. And what it is, it's making sure that everybody has a side of them that's visual, aural, and kinesthetic. Some of the sides, some people are very, very visual, and some people are very kinesthetic, and some people are, and it's not something like you take a shot and get all three of those or one of those, but it, part of it is that if you're going to communicate either in learning or dealing with people in any way, you are also have to try to balance those oral, kinesthetic, and visual things, and you use it sometimes by words that you use. If you're talking to somebody, you can also. This is a lot more complicated than I'm telling it, and I'm making it in a.
No, sure.
Yeah. For example, sometimes your eye motions will tell you whether you're thinking orally, visually, or kinesthetically. So if I'm sitting here and we're talking here, but if I want to say something visual, my eyes would go up like, well, you can't see it, but I can see that you got a point there. If I'm hearing something, my eyes might go back sideways. Like, did you hear that sound?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. Then the other option is feel. And what it is you look down. I see what you're saying is probably true. I see what you're saying.
Yeah.
Bandler and Grinder did some research to start this thing on geniuses. And they found out that people like Stravinsky, T.S. Eliot, Martha Graham, all different parts of the world, they did research on just them being people, their normal stuff, these geniuses, and they found out that, in fact, that's what they were doing. They were able to unify all visual, oral, and kinesthetic, so that when you flip your hands out, that means something. I actually teach a class in the law department in the summer of people, of future lawyers. And I do a whole sessions on neurolinguistic programming for lawyers coming up. And I make them each give a speech of two words. They have to stand in the back. They come in front to the rest of their colleagues in the class, and they have to give a speech. The speech is simply this, the beginning and the end of the speech. Hello, my name is, whatever the name is, pause, thank you, join the line. Mm-hmm. Watch the next person come up. Watch the next person come up. Watch the next. After it's all done, I always say, how many were nervous about coming up and giving that speech? 90% of the hands go up. I've never done anything like that. I said, okay, could I have your name? Because I never want to have you as a lawyer.
I was going
to
say, if you got somebody whose life is on the line, you're yeah. nervous about saying, hello, my name is.
And they laugh about it, yeah, of course. Yeah. But that's part of the whole oral kinesthetic. We do a lot, as you well know, we have adapted bowing when we give a recital. That's an old thing of that was done at Illinois in the early days, because the first percussion ensemble with credit at Illinois, they wanted to have respect. So what did they do? Everybody wore a suit, a tie, and a white shirt. Mm-hmm. So that they could be respected like other instruments. Mm-hmm. That's a visual thing.
Yeah.
Now, did they play well? Probably not. Probably not.
Perception is reality.
And that's kind of what this is based upon. But it's a true basis of watching people do that and how they respond to you. Example. I think you already know this, but I'm going to say it anyway. I have this hallway is full of my family too. Mm-hmm. It's a different family, and I'm here every day. Mm-hmm. I'm here not every day, not like 7 days a week, yeah, by any stretch of imagination, but I can tell every day when a student comes in, they don't have to play a note. I can tell what kind of a day they're having. Mm-hmm. And I am not the kind of teacher who get in here and play this. Now I don't really care. I've got to go deeper than that. And that's been part of my successes. Mm-hmm. Is that the most important thing in a kid's life is not whether they can play scales today. Mm-hmm. I want them to do. I have a curriculum that you have to follow. And take your time. If you want to be here 6 years, that's fine. I don't care, but you're going to have to go through this. Mm-hmm. And everybody has emotions. Everybody, and so I use a lot of neuro-linguistic programming. Thank you, Michael Kolres, for doing this for me. Mm-hmm. In which I have to teach every one of them differently, mm-hmm, different processes to get them. And what I do, I'm getting pretty good at finding out whether they're visual, oral, or kinesthetic. And they always know that I'm doing something weird. Mm-hmm. and they'll say, am I visual, oral? And I never tell them. Mm-hmm. Because when I tell them, then that puts a whole new thing on their shoulder that they have to do,
yeah,
rather than train them that way.
Yeah.
And so that's kind of the basis for
The reason I bring it up is because I'm in town right now, not in Akron, but I'm in Dover doing some preliminary research on a new project with this playwright. His name's Ayn Gordon, and we did a show that premiered 2 years ago called Radicals in Miniature, and he had directed two of So's projects, first the one called Where We Live, and then another project called A Gun Show. And in Where We Live...
Oh, I knew about the gun show for some reason. Yeah.
Yeah, and Where We Live, there's a monologue that I delivered there in the middle of the show. Mm-hmm. And I had never really done anything like that in a show. I had done some, like, little bit of text and stuff, but never a, like, 10-minute monologue with... There's some music along with it, but there I was telling a story. And Ayn comes out of the New York theater world. He did some writing for the show Will and Grace. He played... Spalding Gray, who's a monologist, who he did it on Broadway for like 6.5 weeks, wow, 8 shows a week, like delivering monologues. And so, wow, this is what he does for a living.
Very cool.
And we were in rehearsal, and I was, you know, I'm giving this monologue, and I'm gesticulating. I'm like, my hands are like, well, yeah, like just moving all around. And he comes up to me and he's like, the next time you do it, we're going to do it again. Put your hands on your lap, and you're not allowed to take your hands off your knees. And I said, okay, whatever. And, you know, and, started doing a thing, and about 30 seconds into it, I just broke into tears. I mean, the story was all about my dad dying. You know, this place, the show where we live was about place and where folks, where you're from, and how that affects the way you are as a person. And for me, that particular experience, living in a home where my father was dying, really recontextualized the way I saw what a home was, for better and worse. Not you know, it's just, it's not a good or a bad thing. It's just true. It's just, for me, this was the truth. And by putting my hands on my lap, I was forcing myself. I was emoting through my hands. All of my real emotions were going this way, which was a way of distracting from it coming out of here. And so by forcing myself out of the kinesthetic to the purely aural and having to deal with that, I wasn't ready. And I just melted down. And I was forced to deal with the real issue at hand that I was bypassing by using all of this. And it hit me at that moment. I'm like, shit, this is what Dr. Snyder was talking about. Accessing different parts of your psyche, the way your brain is piecing together information. You know, I had worn a pretty smooth groove with this.
Yeah.
But the fresh snow, the fresh powder was in this. And it was just like I was slamming down a hill at 100 miles an hour, and I don't know where I'm going. And I just, the only thing I do was cry. And then did that twice. I cried a little less the next time. And now I can access, I can do this with control.
Mm-hmm.
It's a tool.
Yeah.
It's not, in the same way that playing the first line of stick control is a tool.
Yeah.
This is now a tool for me. And it's like, oh shit, this is what actors do. Actors don't just learn how to cry. They learn how to cry. They learn that if they can't cry, they know exactly what to think about, where to put their hands, so that they can access that emotion as quickly as possible.
Yeah. There's some other interesting things that I've experimented with. When I was in a wheelchair because I had broken my hip, mm-hmm. and my wife would push me around to events and stuff just because.
Did you make her put the sign that said King Larry on the back, or was
No, I didn't. Okay. I did not do that. I did not. But I found that some of my friends, because I was in a wheelchair, they had difficulty finding something to say to me and talk to me.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, and they would be nice and polite. Hi, how's it going? And then wander away. Another thing that's really fun to do is when you're in a situation, a cocktail party, and everybody's got a cocktail in their hands. Everybody's holding something.
Mm-hmm.
If you're not holding something, it's almost like having guests at your home, and everybody's having beer or wine, and there's one person that doesn't. That makes you feel uncomfortable.
Mm-hmm.
What you do, I've learned this from Colgrass, what you do is you get, if you're in a situation and you don't drink alcohol or you don't drink anything, fill up a glass with water and just carry it around.
Mm-hmm.
And you get respected.
Yeah. Oh, it's like the age old, like if you just are wearing a blazer and you have a clipboard, you can basically get into any building in the world.
Yeah.
You can just walk right by security. And there was like a big an art heist that happened. I don't remember what the museum, the Frick or something like that. And people just walked in. They were dressed up as like maintenance people. They just walked in, took paintings right off the wall, walked right by the security guards. Security guards were like, see you later, fellas. It's like, if you carry yourself with authority, then you get respect.
It's part of society.
Yeah.
And so neurolinguistic programming just, what's the word I'm looking for, puts it in an academic situation of what you're learning and what you're doing and how you're doing it.
Yeah.
And it's really interesting.
Well, where do you hope percussion studies go? In the next, so you've been teaching for 39 years. You're about to hit the 40th. Give me your crystal ball. Where you hope in the next 40 years things go?
Well, again, I go back to the word of curious. I don't think I can identify this. I think it's the good parts is that if we have curious people, therefore we have new music.
Mm-hmm.
If we're going to play Bach and Beethoven the same way for centuries, that's fine. But you're really escaping the curiousness of new music, and I'm in great hopes. And of course, electronic is any kind of electronic stuff is going to go on. I do believe that we are starting, as you well we have defined here, that steel pan and some very interesting instruments are going to be developed. Mm-hmm. Even in my own studio, we got some crazy stuff going on right now about a dampening of a vibraphone that some grad students are messing around with. Mm-hmm. That's all in a good thing. That's all good. I really do believe that. And the more we do of that, I think society is going to appreciate different cultures a lot more with steel pan, with Bernard Wuma playing African drums for and our destiny of bringing that. The thing that I worry about is being so into looking at YouTube for stuff and answering things like that, getting students to actually be curious about, well, why did Xenakis do this, do I think? Maybe I'll have the wrong answer, but at least I'm thinking about what he could have thought about. Yeah. So I'm hoping that the next generation does that. And I think they will. I think we're just kind of, we are, you know what? So percussion is making a living on percussion ensemble stuff. Mm-hmm. Okay. You're not millionaires, but guess what? You are doing it. Mm-hmm. And in my generation, there was no such thing as a professional percussion ensemble that was going on tour to do anything. Mm-hmm. I mean, we gotta look back at just some pieces like Rhythmica's, mm-hmm. or going, oh my God, that is so weird. Yeah. How about Feldman, King of Denmark? That's just weird stuff. That's not music. Yeah. And then look what we're doing. We're having David Lang play, write pieces, major pieces, major people doing major things. Yeah. I think your approach to having, and I can't think of her name, with the orange hair and a guitar.
Oh, Sharon Nova.
Yeah. That's a combination, man, mm-hmm. of contemporary music, of world music. I think there's another melding, maybe past your generation, mm-hmm. of pop music, of this, of that. I don't know.
Yeah, I think...
I mean, do you agree with that or
not? Yeah, I mean, I don't know where it's going, but I think...
Well, we don't. No, none of us know where it's going.
Yeah, I think the curiosity, I think, is the key. I mean, that's what you mentioned up front, was just thinking about, like, not waiting for the answer.
Right.
I think that is the one thing I can say that's the common thread amongst the four of us, and so is that we're very impatient. Like, I don't want to wait for somebody else to tell me what the answer is. I'd way rather figure out the wrong answer right now by myself.
And learn from the I did that. I shouldn't have done that.
Right.
I won't do that again.
Right. And I think that's a potential problem with that students will have to deal with, given that they have every answer out there now. They've got every piece that they could possibly, even a piece that's written today exists more ubiquitously than Merlin did or than Time for Marimba did. I mean, and those were written 20, 30 years ago, you know, just because of the access to the pipeline of the internet. Yeah. Once it's in there, it is there forever. And I think that's something students are going to have to grapple with. And it's something I try to get, like my students at Princeton, their final project they have to do for me is a research paper on the history of the steel band as it relates to Trinidad and Tobago's history specifically. And so they look at me like, and every once in a while they'll come back and be like, well, I can't find any books on this. And I was like, I know. Because it's so young. This is within the last 100 years, that since around World War II is when it sort of blew up. But what I want you to do is, I mean, obviously it had its roots well before that, but it was post-World War II when tuners left Trinidad and went to the United States. They went to London. They went to Japan. They went to Canada. Like, I want you to do is tell me why you think that was the case. Like, why do you think? Like, as far as I'm concerned, it had to do with people as far back as Sir Walter Raleigh and the use of Trinidad. It had to do with slavery. It had to do with Spanish colonialization. Christopher Columbus. Like, those decisions that happened in the 1400s and the 1500s in one way or another, had they not happened, had Raleigh not done what he did, had Christopher Columbus not discovered Trinidad in 1498, like, I don't think we would be sitting here in the exact way that we are now. So what I want you to do is tell me why you think that happened. And you might be wrong, but you're going to all go online and see 15 different contradictory stories about the history of the steel band by 15 different tuners, 15 different performers, young people, old people. I want you to synthesize all that and tell me why you think. Don't just give me some article that you read.
That's beautiful, man. That's I would be interested in the differences of my public school education teaching here, using one term as opposed to what your common answer is at Princeton. And this would be when you have something and you say to them, "What do you think?" Mm-hmm. Does the Princeton student different than the Akron student? We don't know that.
I don't know that.
But that's it's a good thing to say, because my students, especially the ones that have been told what to do and how to do it and when to do it for all their lives, mm-hmm. get nervous about that. Well, some have said, "You're the teacher. You tell me what to do."
Yeah. Well, a lot of the Princeton students, the first thing they ask is like, "Well, how do you want your sources cited?" I said, I don't care. That's not what I'm asking for. Like, give me your YouTube links. Give me, like, you need to show me everything that you looked at. And then from what you looked at, tell me the story you think. Tell me the story in your words. Don't just transcribe a YouTube video or copy some article that was written in The Guardian from 1972. Read the article, cite it, but then explain in your own words what you think were some things that either people aren't talking about that they should be talking about that you feel is important. Maybe it was the election of some politician in Trinidad that had some passed some bill that no one really talks about. Like, and you happen to find that information. Tell me that. But don't just give me the sort of boilerplate experience.
Yeah.
And I tell them, I don't care if you're wrong. What I want to see, the way you're going to fail that paper is if I can tell you're just making stuff up.
Yeah.
And that you haven't actually dug deep enough into this.
Research.
That's easy for me to tell. I can spot a BSer far away. But if you're genuinely thinking about what brought us here to Princeton University playing steel band, I can tell.
I have the same kind of situation where I teach percussion literature class, and the project is take a piece that you're playing and you analyze it.
Yeah.
And I can tell in a minute if you've just copied something out of a book.
Yeah.
I said, whatever you do, the worst thing you can do is say something like, the suspended cymbal roll went three counts. Okay, but why did the composer write it?
Mm-hmm.
For what reason? And you can be wrong, but give me an idea you think Xenakis wrote that.
Right.
Why Keiko Abe wrote that.
Like, did Sibelius write so many timpani rolls because he hated the timpanist and was just, or the timpanist had bad rhythm in his orchestra he's writing for?
Or he liked it, the timpanist. He was
drones.
A friend. Yeah.
He liked drones and, you know, whatever. Or maybe he was really drunk every time he went to write the timpani part and was like, I don't know.
Yeah, you can't do wrong. The only time you can do wrong is when you just comping somebody else's ideas.
There's a really great podcast, just before we wrap, it's called Hardcore History by Dan Carlin, is the guy who does it. And he does like 6-hour podcast. It's like a 6-hour long episode about the history of the Mongolian hordes. And what he talks about isn't the on this date Genghis Khan was born and on this date he sacked this village. It's like, what happened? What did the village smell like when it was sacked?
Yeah.
Before it was sacked, what did it smell like whenever everything was in flames? Did you know that, like, some crazy percentage of the total human population has Genghis Khan's DNA? Because he raped and pillaged his way across all of, like, Asia.
Oh.
And it's like, whoa, that is nuts. Like, there's DNA of Genghis Khan in most of us because of what he did. Like, what? You know, I care. And it's not about dates. It's not about facts. It's about the context and the sort of butterfly. And it's really fascinating. And I think as a student, that was something I was sort of forced to deal with because I didn't have all. I was just like, oh, you know.
Yeah.
But Larry, I really appreciate your time, taking the time to do this. And
I appreciate the cup of coffee.
Hey, it's literally the least I could have done this morning.
And I must tell you that I've really totally enjoyed this, even on Saturday morning.
I know. I apologize.
No. It's good. This has been fun for me.
Well, I think about you, and I'm looking forward to talking to Joan on Monday too, and Matt tomorrow. Like, I think of you all, and you in particular, every time I walk on stage, every time I'm responding to an email or. Something leads me back to something I learned here.
That's what a teacher wants. I think you're exaggerating, but I can tell you that it does make me feel good.
Well, it goes to everything. I mean, every luau I played, every bat mitzvah I was hired to play. Not that at the moment I was feeling like this is the best gig ever, and I've made it because I'm playing Bahama Breeze three nights a week or something. You're like, but what I learned from those experiences... I take with me on every SO gig, on every NYU gig, and I really do.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that very much.
I hope we get to do this again soon.
Absolutely.
All right. Well,
maybe next time over a beer.
Let's do an 8 p.m. hang. Okay. We'll get Cindy in the mix too.
That's true. And your wife and my wife can tell us how wrong we have been.
Yeah, that's why we don't invite them to this podcast.
Why did you say that? Because that
I'm going to do one with Cindy tomorrow and just
it'll
be the the end of your game. All right. Well, Larry, thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right. Take care.
Okay, everybody. I hope you enjoyed that podcast. I certainly did. All right, you're listening to a tune called High Moss by the Calypsonian David Rutter, performed live by the University of Akron Steel Drum Band, alongside Tom Miller and Andy Norell. Just going to put this little side note out there. I highly recommend everybody listening to this take 2 hours out of your life, just once, and sit down and talk with somebody without a cell phone on. Even record it. There's something that it adds a little extra pressure to the conversation. Can't recommend it enough. You learn a lot, and about yourself, frankly, and that's important. All right, take care, everybody. Talk to you soon. Bye.
Forgive us this day our daily weakness as we seek to cast our mortal burdens on your city. And what you say? Oh, merciful Father, in this bacchanal season where men lose their reason, but most of us just wonder why. Have a good time. We're looking for a night because we're feeling fine, Lord. Bone day, bone day, bone day. As we jump up and down in this crazy town, send us some music for some healing. Oh, what do you say? Boom, 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 baby, day, oh, yeah. Well, everybody hand raise. Everybody give praise. And raise. If you know what I mean, put up your finger. Know what I mean? Put up your hand if you know what I mean. Put up your finger if you know what I mean. Then scream, oh, oh, oh. Give Jah his praises, yes. Oh, oh, oh. Let Jah be praised. Oh, oh, oh. The Father. Vibration raise. So on this good night, everybody come and celebrate, yeah. Oh, everybody come and celebrate. See the ragamuffin congregate, yeah. Oh, everybody come and celebrate. And everybody sing it, ooh, eh, eh, ooh, eh, eh. And I'm a country, yeah. Well, let me hear you sing it, ooh, eh, eh. But what do you say? Bonde, bonde, bonde. Forgive us this day our daily weakness as as we seek to cast our mortal burdens on your city. And what you say? Home day, home day, home day. On this lovely day when we come out to play and we come out to sway and we break in away. Some will say what they have to say, but only you know the pain the people feeling. People, what you say? As it was in the beginning of Juve, good vibes still carnival, choose the ending. Everybody! Ooh, 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 yeah. Everybody hand raise. Everybody give praise. Everybody hand raise. If you know what I mean, put up your finger, know what I mean. Put up your hand if you know what I mean. Put up your finger if you know what I mean. Then scream, oh, oh, oh. Give God his praises, yes. Oh, oh, oh. Let Jah be praised. Oh, oh, oh. The Father in his mercy, he sent a little music to make the vibration raise. So on this good night, everybody come and celebrate. Come celebrate your life. Everybody come and celebrate. See the ragamuffin congregate, yeah. Oh, oh, oh. Everybody come and celebrate. And everybody singing, ooh, eh, eh, ooh, eh, eh. I love my country, yeah. Well, let me hear you singing, ooh, eh, eh, ooh, eh, eh. I'm feeling Irish. Well, let me hear you singing, ooh, eh, eh, ooh, eh, eh. I love my country, yeah. Well, let me hear you singing, ooh, eh, eh. But everybody say yeah, say yeah, ho, yeah, 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 ho, yeah, 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 ho. I want to rock my soul, I want to rock my soul, I want to rock my soul, I want to rock my soul. In the